Wild foods are what we're after, and we'll munch with merry laughter as we sample all that nature has to yield. Cattail pancakes, maple syrup, wild rice, rosehip jam, acorn bread, wild ginger, mushrooms, peppergrass, and grapes.
We are going to search for wild foods during this week's edition of Tell Joy Where to Go. Now, I know you're not going to tell me where to go to find your secret morel mushroom stash, but tell us what you are finding from mushrooms and beyond and what you are making with your harvest. Maybe if you have a favorite wild edible. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is the hour each week when we celebrate Wisconsin life, and today we are going to celebrate spring foraging and the bounty of foods that we can find in nature. And we will welcome your finds and your questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, and you might want to post a photo of your bounty. You can also tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Sam Thayer, an expert in edible plants. He's also a maple syrup producer, a wild rice harvester, an organic orchard owner, and he is the author of The Forager's Harvest, a guide to identifying, harvesting, and preparing edible wild plants and nature's garden. Good morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Joy. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you back. So first off, just generally, why should we get out and forage for wild edibles?
Well, you know, foraging encapsulates all the good things in life into one activity. You get exercise, you get really delicious and really nutritious food, it gets you out appreciating nature. It's a great way for all the generations of a family to do something together outside. I can't think of one reason not to go foraging.
Yeah. Well, one reason maybe is that I don't know how to identify what's good and what's not. What's if you're a novice, what kind of advice do you have?
Well, my advice is the basic ground rule of foraging, safety-wise, is you only eat something when you know what it is. And I tell people to start with a plant, with one plant, and a plant you already know. Most likely you already know a plant that you don't know is edible. And that's the easy way to go, one plant at a time, because once you have a good experience with that plant, then you will remember it and you'll have it for the rest of your life. And within a short period of time, you'll have learned six or seven, and all of a sudden the landscape starts to look different around you. It starts to look like a very complex garden rather than just a bunch of random greenery.
Yeah, and I do know a few, and I know that foraging goes well beyond mushrooms, but it seems from my Facebook feed that people are all excited about the morel mushrooms that they're finding this time of year. Is the morel mushroom season peaking or on the downside, or do you know what's going on?
I would say we're almost exactly at the peak right now. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been out for a few weeks in southern Wisconsin, and they're just starting to appear in northern Wisconsin. So I would say we're right about the best time of year. Usually Mother's Day weekend, especially in the Driftless area of Wisconsin, there are just thousands and thousands of morel pickers out. Mm-hmm. My birthday is May 10th, and I like to go morel picking every year on my birthday.
That's great. Did you find some?
Well, I didn't go this year because I had a car issue. So I stayed home with my children, and we picked violets and did some other things.
Aw. You know what? A friend of mine made violet jam. Do you eat your violets?
Yes, yes. my daughter wanted to make candied violets, but today we're going to collect violets and make violet jam, which you make just out of the flowers. You mix them with a very small amount of water and blend it. The unfortunate thing is you have to mix so much sugar with it to turn it into jam, but I do things like that every now and then.
Yeah, and my friend mentioned that she needed quite a few violets, too, to make some jam. She makes a lot, though, so.
You do need a lot of violets, but if you start looking, you'll see some large blue patches in a lot of people's lawns. I mean, they're just they can be very common. And today I'm going to use something I've never used before to pick violets. I'm going to try a blueberry rake to pick violets and see how that works.
Oh, interesting. Well, my lawn, my yard is full of violets, so I can just go right into my own backyard and I'll have probably enough. And that's the thing, is that you can forage in your own backyard or your neighborhood park, or, you know, you don't have to, you know, it's not like you have to go into the deep wilds to find some of this stuff.
Oh, absolutely, and that's a great thing about it, is it costs nothing and you can do it anywhere. I don't care where you live. I don't care if you're in downtown Milwaukee. There's good foraging near your house,
yeah.
Maybe in your backyard. If you've got some soil and there's greenery on it, there's going to be something edible. And I, of course, encourage people to, you know whose land you're foraging on and know what the regulations are. You know, in our state parks, you can pick mushrooms, nuts, berries. They don't want you picking leaves. So each location is going to have different regulations, but if it's your own backyard, you can pick whatever you want.
Yeah. Here's a comment that really made me smile on Facebook. Chris on Facebook says, my sister snuck dandelions into my elderly father's burritos this week. If you chop them up, no one knows. Pick the new tender leaves. Also get the tender shoots of nettles that are out. Get them while they're safe. Does that mean that, I don't know, pesticide use and such will make them less safe later on?
Well, I don't know if they're referring to that or the stingers of the nettles.
Oh, okay.
Stinging nettles will sting as soon as it comes up. Wood nettle, you have about a one-week grace period where it's not going to sting. So they could be referring to that.
They probably are, yeah.
Yeah, that's two things that we've eaten multiple times this week in our house. And I'm standing here looking at what I call my nettle garden, which is just I tend it. I've let the weeds creep out into my yard, and I kind of manage this as my wild garden, and it's full of nettles right now asking me to pick them.
Yeah, and the nettle looks like a circular, it's a part of a fern, is that what it is?
No, that's the fiddlehead. You're thinking of fiddlehead.
Oh, okay. So what is it, what exactly is the nettle?
Well, the nettles have, the wood nettle has a broad leaf, kind of heart-shaped leaf, and they tend to be from knee high to 6 feet high. The stinging nettles tend to be from 4 to 7 feet tall. But their overall aspect looks something like a mint. You know,
okay.
The stinging nettle has pairs of jagged leaves, and they're in opposite sets along the stem.
And the fiddleheads must be out because I see pictures of those too on Facebook. Is that right?
Yes. Mm. Yeah, fiddleheads are out. Depending on what part of the state you're in, they are past prime in the southern part of the state, and they're just about perfect in the central part of the state and just starting to come out in the northern part.
Yeah.
You get a long season for those because they come out 3 weeks earlier in the shade than in the open.
Ah, interesting. And what about dandelions? Are you a fan of dandelion salads and wines and such?
Well, I've had dandelion wine. I've never made it. It's okay. Dandelion greens, we love. And the dandelions are kind of a skill. You know, a lot of people go to the grocery store, they don't buy bitter greens like escarole or endive. And if you don't like that kind of green, you're not going to like it in the wild either. But I encourage people to learn to use greens in their cooking because they are so good for you. And there's such an incredible variety of wild greens. So with dandelion, it's important to get the leaf early. And I only pick the upper half of the leaf, and I'll clip it with scissors as I go. And you can, you know, get them very fast. They're real common. And we usually eat our dandelion greens cooked, not in salad. So the traditional Greek way or Mediterranean way to cook dandelion greens is fried in olive oil with a little bit of onion or garlic. And you can hardly go wrong with quality dandelion greens that are cooked that way.
Oh, my goodness. Does that sound good? That's the first time I've ever heard about that. I'm going to have to try that. That's great. So what, you know, we'll go into more depth as we go along and more details on what to look for and how to find these things. But what else is out? What is it? You know, it seems that, you know, spring is a great time for foraging. What else is out there that they haven't touched on yet?
Well, you know, spring, there's not many types of mushrooms that are out. You know, there's the morel, and there's one called pheasant back or dryad saddle, which is not nearly as good as a morel, but there's not a lot of options for mushrooms. But it is absolutely a fantastic time of year for greens and shoots. So some of the stuff that's real common around the state, we have, you know, garlic mustard, which the DNR encourages you to pick and get rid of, and a whole bunch of other types of mustard greens, like watercress, is perfect right now. There's one that was mentioned in your song, pepperweed. That was on my list I wanted to mention because it's not so well known, but it is, it's got a slight peppery flavor, and it's in the mustard family, just delicious. Fiddleheads, the ramps, or wild leeks are at their full size right now. There's some kind of exotic ones that are real common, like there's one called cow parsnip, and that is a traditional vegetable that Native Americans still use a lot in the Pacific Northwest. And it's a relative of celery with a strange lemony scent in it also. Not so well known, but pretty common, is caraway. Wild caraway makes a traditional Norwegian soup in the spring, and just caraway greens cooked in butter and mixed with beef broth or fish broth just makes a fantastic and very simple soup.
Yeah, let me jump in because we'll talk more about how to find these delicacies after we check the latest news. We are foraging for wild food during this edition of Tell Joy Where to Go. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We are talking with one of the best foragers around. Sam Thayer is an expert in edible plants. He is the author of The Forager's Harvest, a guide to identifying, harvesting, and preparing wild plants and nature's garden. He also is a maple syrup producer, a wild rice harvester, and an organic orchard owner. We welcome your questions for him about finding these wild delicacies and what you might do with these wild delicacies. And we wonder if you are out and about looking for food in your backyard or your neighborhood park or your woods. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, I wanted to focus in on a couple of various foods. I'm actually going to start with where you left off. You had some interesting, unusual foods that I had not heard of that you're a big fan of, apparently. Did you say there's a wild caraway? Sam, what does that look like? Where do you find that?
Well, caraway, see, this is what's great about wild food is you can use all of the parts of a good food plant. You know, a lot of people don't realize that caraway was grown for hundreds of years as a green leafy vegetable and as a root vegetable. We just know about the seeds because it's easy to turn it into a commodity. Well, that's kind of a sideshow with caraway. It is a fantastic vegetable, and it's the very same plant that's cultivated for the seed, and it does grow wild throughout the state. It's actually more common northward, and it tends to grow in slightly moist soil. I see it when I'm driving. I'll see patches of it blooming on the roadsides almost anywhere in the state. It's traditionally made into a springtime soup with fish broth or beef broth in Norway. But I've tried it with all kinds of broth, and it's great. And to me, that's one thing. It's so exciting about foraging is you can have these really good foods that you can't buy anywhere. A lot of times the forage foods that are well-known, like fiddleheads and ramps, those are well-known because they have a shelf life. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this stuff has no shelf life. But you can get out there and pick it and eat it within 20 minutes or 20 seconds.
Yeah. And what is this pepperweed that you were mentioning and was in the song that we had played earlier? Where do you find that?
Well, you find pepperweed anywhere that's disturbed, dry, and usually sandy. Every listener has seen it. When it blooms, it has no leaves, or when it'll be just covered with small round pods. And that's not really a time to use it. But when it first comes up, it's hard to explain what a plant looks like over the radio, but it's a small plant, knee-high or shorter, and it has... it's kind of like broccoli with a slightly spicy zing to it, and it is related to broccoli in the mustard family. It's slightly hairy stems, and it is abundant statewide. The time to pick that would be starting now until probably the first or second week of June.
And we do have your website linked to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I suppose we can see photos of a lot of these plants that we're talking about.
Yeah, I have some of them up there. There are a lot of good resources that have come out for foraging in the last few years, as far as books also. And yeah. There are some great websites. There's this Texas Foraging, which has a lot of the same plants as Wisconsin, believe it or not. Some of these things you can get a good picture there also.
We will take calls from our listeners for Sam Thayer, who is an expert in edible plants and the author of a couple of books on foraging, including The Forager's Harvest. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Jared in Fenimore is with us. Hi, Jared.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
It's an honor to be on the air with you. I got his book about 2 years ago and it fully changed my aspect on foraging, and it really made me a well-rounded outdoorsman, I'd like to say, because I hunt and fish. And this is a great book and a great way to get outdoors also if you're not into hunting and fishing.
Yeah. And when you say it really changed your life in a way, you added the greens to your wild foods.
Yeah. I've been an avid gardener for a long time, but wild asparagus, that's big for me right now. And we'll go, me and my wife will even go in the fall and find where it's bloomed and, like, write down on a map where we located this next to this post or this telephone pole. It's kind of a fun game for us, and then we pickle it a lot of times.
That is great. Pickled asparagus, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and is the wild asparagus up now, Jared?
Yes, it is in certain spots. I got 2 pounds the other day, about 2 pounds of it.
Oh boy, and I love that. I love how you identify it later in the year,
yeah.
So you can mark it. Yeah,
yeah. It's I think wild asparagus is more tender and way better than any asparagus you can buy in a store at any time of the year.
And Brianne, my producer, says you're also finding some mushrooms.
Yes, some morels, and also you talked about the pheasant mushrooms. I haven't tried them yet, but I got a couple of those picked, and I'm going to try those.
Well, how should he try those, Sam?
Well, you know, mushrooms kind of lend themselves to the same kind of cooking, no matter what the mushroom is.
Yeah, just butter and stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, your first try, just fry it with butter. I mean,
yeah.
And then you can work from there into more complicated recipes. Just decide if you like it first.
Yeah, and that was the pheasant back. That's like a, yeah, anyway, the pheasant back and the morels are the two that are really available right now, Sam.
I mean, there's some others that can be found, but, you know, mushrooms really start to heat up in July, and then through October is really the peak for mushroom hunting, but there's a few other kinds right now.
Yeah, what about wild asparagus? What can you tell us about that, Sam?
I can't really elaborate on what he said. It's great, you know, and it's another thing that's statewide. It likes sandy soil, but you can find it... I would say we're right about peak season for there. It coincides really well with morels.
Yeah, it's funny because I do think of wild asparagus with lilacs and Mother's Day. That's I associate those together, and now I realize that it's also that's when the morels are out. So the lilacs are out. So I guess in fact, Brianne Chasso, my producer, was foraging yesterday for. Morels, I think, at her parents' place, and she says she and her sister got like 2 pounds of them.
Yeah, she said they had a pretty decent haul.
Yeah, that's not bad. Hey, how do I know if I have a real morel or a fake morel? Isn't there a fake morel out there?
Yeah, there's a false morel.
Okay.
The false morel kind of has a gangly, convoluted cap attached to the stem, whereas the true morel is hollow. And so the stem comes up and then widens out into the top spore-producing part. The real morel has kind of the honeycomb-like surface with, a network of ridges. The false morel is more just folds. At a glance they look similar, but if you actually pick them up, they're... if the top is hollow, you've got a real morel.
Oh, okay. We had someone who, Chris on Facebook, who says, make sure you shake your morels out so the spores go back in the soil and cut them in half. And then a little less appetizing here. Last spring, I found a slug in one. Mmm, escargot.
Yeah, I don't know about the eating slugs part. So there's a lot of talk about letting your morels go to spore when you collect them. Mycologists tell us that that is really not the deal that some foragers think it is. Foragers tend to imagine when they pick a mushroom of any kind that they've picked an organism, but they haven't. They've picked a very small piece of an organism, which may be decades or centuries old. So like when you pick an apple tree, you don't need to make sure you spread all your apple seeds so that apples don't disappear. Likewise, morels aren't going to disappear because someone does or doesn't spread the spores. It helps. It's always, you know, it's always a good idea, but it's not as vital to mushroom ecology as is often said.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Dino in the Upper Peninsula is with us. Hi, Dino.
Yeah, way up here in the UP. I tell you, I am blessed because I've got an old-timer up here he's 78 years old. His name is Willie. And I am blessed because when it comes to wild shrooms, he knows where to go. And he gave me a recipe for these things and how to cook them. And what he does is at 350 in the oven, when you get we call them shrooms up here.
Yeah.
Butter and cinnamon.
Huh.
That's the ticket right there.
Cinnamon, okay.
What kind of mushroom are you cooking with cinnamon?
What kind of mushroom are you putting the cinnamon on?
What do you call them, morels or whatever? We go up there. I've been up here, back up here after 23 years. I came up here from Chicago, and he knows exactly where to go. Yeah.
Well, and hold on, Dino. That would be a good way for me to go hunting is knowing someone who knows where to go. So, Sam, are you questioning putting cinnamon on your morel mushrooms?
No, maybe culinarily. I've never done that, and I've never heard of it. I'm not saying that it's dangerous.
No.
I've never prepared them that way or heard of that. So I'm curious when I hear of a new recipe like that.
Yeah, and I don't know if I mentioned this. I know I've mentioned this before, but I have not found morels in the wild, but I have purchased them at the farmers markets. And a couple of different times, I just have failed, I guess, in making them. I've just kind of sautéed them in butter, and it was like, meh. I mean, do you think they're something to do cartwheels over, Sam?
I think morels are good. Mm-hmm. I would say they rank in my top 10, you know, favorite wild mushrooms. But one of the reasons people are so excited about them is because they're the first good mushroom that comes out in a good crop.
Yeah.
I love morels, and I'm not knocking morels, but there's a whole bunch of other really good mushrooms that will be coming up late in the year. I mean, there's chanterelles and black trumpets, and just the common meadow mushroom. I think all of those are equally good, but, I don't do cartwheels over morels. Maybe I don't know.
And I'm not trying to diss them either, but it just, I thought they were fine. I didn't know if I would go searching for them. But if I do want to search for them, I guess you find them by, like, rotting wood or something like that?
I'll tell you some of the best associations.
Okay.
Dead elms that have been dead for less than 3 years and still have bark clinging to the branches is a good way. Old apple trees... dead apple trees, old and dead butternut trees are good. Living stands of white ash are good. Dead stands, dead white ash also, which there's now a lot of in southern Wisconsin. Those are probably the most common associations where I find them. Also, any place that has burned recently, particularly conifer forests that have burned, can be really good morel sites. But they can pop up almost anywhere.
Oh, and by the way, the Morel Mushroom Festival in Muscadet is taking place not this weekend, but next weekend, May 20th and 21st. And I know a lot of people like to go celebrate the morel mushroom in Muscadet.
Well, there's a tent here I want to tell you about.
Oh, this is Dino again. Hi, Dino.
there's a hint here that I found out about that I was not aware of. Up here in the UP, well, Upper Peninsula, around white birch trees, that's where they grow up here.
Neat. Yeah, they're not stealing your birch trees there.
I'm giving away some secrets here.
No. And you know, we're Dino, I know you also had a question about wild mint. You want to know what to do with that?
Yeah. There's a whole ton of wild mint bushes up here, and I know how to find them, but I don't know, you know, how you can cook these things, you know, and like to put them in like a fruit pie or whatnot.
Do you have a way to use a lot of wild mint, Sam?
Well, we do use a fair amount of wild mint. I like to get it when it's young. And use it fresh. A lot of people think of mint as only a seasoning, but really, it's a vegetable. It's with a strong flavor. But I'll put a little bit of mint in chicken soup. I'll put it. You can put mint in a gyros. You know, just a little bit. There's so many things you can do with mint. In fact, I had a wild tea blend that we make for ourselves that includes wild mint just this morning before I called you. I hardly know where to begin. We dry it and crumble it, and then sift it through a strainer to get out the, you know, stem pieces, and then we have a jar of it that we use for all kinds of things through the year.
Neat. Colleen on Facebook says, "I have a fridge full of ramps right now. Never cooked with ramps. Any suggestions?"
It's like
a garlic type taste, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not as strong as garlic, but it's stronger than an onion, and it's got its own little taste that I can't really describe that's different than either one of those. Mm-hmm. You can use them in almost any recipe that would call for garlic or onions. I mean, I make fried greens quite a bit in the spring, and I like to put ramp leaves in that. Recently, we had French ramp soup. Like, just take a French onion soup recipe and use the ramp bulbs instead of the onion. There's so much that you can do with that plant. It's important to harvest those sustainably. It's easy to harvest them sustainably, but it's easy to over-harvest them. So I always tell foragers, make sure you leave at least one-third of every clump there. They tend to grow in clumps they could be 30, 40 years old. They do really well if you leave part of the clump, but that's a plant that's very important not to over-harvest.
Yeah. Good to know. You know, we have just a minute before a news break, but you mentioned it before, but not what you do with it. Garlic mustard, that is another, someone makes pesto with that. It's really good.
Yeah, a lot of people make pesto with that. Mm-hmm. And a little bit earlier in the season, before it flowers, I like to take the stems and strip the leaves and use the stems like sort of like a slightly garlicky asparagus. You got to make sure you get it when the stem is tender for that. And that's probably the two most common uses of it. The leaves have a real strong flavor, so it lends itself well to pesto, but it can overpower a salad unless you use it real sparingly.
We are talking with Sam Thayer, an expert in edible plants. He is the author of The Forager's Harvest, a guide to identifying, harvesting, and preparing wild plants, and Nature's Garden. He also is a maple syrup producer, a wild rice harvester, and an organic orchard owner. And we are talking with him about spring foraging on this edition of Tell Joy Where to Go. What questions do you have? What are you finding? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org.
Grove, Emerald Grove, Cedar Grove, Union Grove, Soldiers Grove, Hales, Carter, Slades, Carter, Abels, Carter, Newber, Carter, Pipersville, Pittsville, Deansville, Reeseville, Janesville, Platteville, Orphanville, Footville, Blanchville, Plainville, Plainfield, Nutterville, Butternut.
I've been over there. Hey, smell that dairy air.
This is a Foraging for Wild Edibles edition of Tell Joy Where to Go. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network, and we are welcoming your finds, the delicacies you are finding out in nature right now, and your questions for our guest, who is an expert forager. He's an expert in edible plants, Sam Thayer. He is the author of The Forager's Harvest, a guide to identifying, harvesting, and preparing wild plants, among other things. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's go to Bob in Hurley next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, what's your question or find?
Dandelions.
Yes, are you eating them?
yeah, everybody's got them, and I just thought I'd share a little tip. My grandparents used to harvest them every spring, and my grandfather would spread a clear plastic sheet over the garden where the dandelions would grow to keep them tender. And I'm just kind of wondering, is this something that that your guests might be familiar with? And then, if not a plastic sheet, how long can you eat dandelions? Can you eat them all summer or just in the spring?
So I'm not familiar with that tactic of spreading a clear plastic sheet over them to keep them tender. I'm familiar with spreading tarps or old blankets or plywood over greens to keep them tender, to keep the light off of them. So that's an interesting technique that I'd like to try or hear more about. As far as the time for using dandelions, you can eat them at any time of year, but I only eat what I really like. So their quality is best in the spring. I would say until about peak bloom for dandelion or slightly after, that's the time that we harvest dandelions. Then we usually move on to another green that we think is at its peak of culinary delight. You know, so you can use them all year, but I think they're much better in the spring.
Yeah. Are there any other common weeds in our backyard that we might want to throw in a salad or prepare in any way?
You know, there's a lot, but one that I would like to mention that is really common is creeping bellflower.
Oh.
So this is a plant that is used to be popular in landscaping. So most homes that are older than 50 or 70 years have this in the yard, or a very large portion of them. And if listeners have it in their yard, they probably know. And a lot of people say, oh, that stuff, you can't keep it out of the lawn. It just takes over. Well, you start eating it, it won't take over so much. In fact, I had a patch in my old house in my yard. And I heard that you couldn't get rid of it, and I took them at their word, and I eliminated it in just one summer by eating it. So the greens are great right now, and you can eat any part of the plant. It has a delicious root, and it has greens that are good raw in a salad. They're great cooked in any number of ways, just a real mild flavor. And then it has a shoot that comes up a little bit later, early summer, and those are also great. It's just a fantastic vegetable, and I profile that plant in my new book that's coming out this fall.
What is that going to be?
It's called Incredible Wild Edibles, and it's going to be coming out on November 1st.
We're gonna try to have you back when that comes out. That'd be great, and we can talk about things that are happening in the fall too, I suppose, huh?
Yeah,
wonderful. We had one of our listeners who couldn't stay with us through the news who wanted any tips you might have for harvesting and using wild leeks. Do you have any?
Sure. No, wild leeks is the same thing as ramps.
Okay.
Another listener had asked about, I'll tell you what we do with them. We have a lot of them on our property. They grow well with maple trees. And we'll go through and pick one leaf from each plant until we get a big pile of them. We'll dehydrate them and then crumble them, and we'll have this wild leek powder that's oniony but also actually very sweet. And you can throw that in. You can put that with fried eggs. You can put it in lasagna. You can put it in a quiche. You can put it in a soup. I mean, it is a really versatile product that you have year round from your ramps or wild leeks, or the leaves chopped fine. Just make a really, anywhere you'd use a scallion. They're good.
Yeah.
They're good raw in a salad. There's some people pickle them. I don't pickle them. They're okay that way. I could probably go on the whole show about it.
Because we're running short on time, let's bring in Mark from Crivets. Hi, Mark.
Hi, yeah. I just had a question about we're going to be going foraging this weekend with the kids and picking morels. But last week I found some beefsteak mushrooms. I think that's what they were called. They were a little bit glossier and darker in color. I'm wondering what the edibleness of those are.
Well, beefsteak mushroom, I usually don't find it this early. They are edible. They're a little bit tougher. They're usually cooked well to soften them. They're a fairly tough mushroom. There's a couple other mushrooms that look sort of like a beefsteak but are really tough, but, you know, not dangerous, just too tough to eat. I've only cooked the beefsteak mushroom maybe two or three times in my life. I don't find it that often.
You know, we're almost out of time. Catherine in the Ashland area has taken wild foraging classes, and her teacher has apparently mentioned your book, Sam. You actually hold classes, don't you?
Yeah, in fact, I have a weekend class starting today. For this weekend, I do one almost every year on Mother's Day weekend.
Oh, but it's sold out, I think.
Yeah, it is. If you go to my website, you can see a number of shorter and longer workshops that I have scheduled. We're in Bruce in northwestern Wisconsin, where we hold our classes, or most of them. I do a little bit of traveling around the state also. I teach workshops at an event called the Midwest Wild Harvest Festival that's held in Prairie du Chien every September. So there's a number of opportunities that people might have to come out in the field, and I can show you things you can eat and tell you some stories about them.
All right, well, I'm signing up. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sam Thayer is a maple syrup producer, wild rice harvester, organic orchard owner, author of The Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden. And as we heard, he's got another book coming out in the fall in November. I think he said it was The Incredible Edible. And we'll have him back in the fall. Thanks very much to Chris Molina and to Brianne Chasso for producing the program. It's time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
No one wants to have an encounter with a bear, but a run-in with a bear and her cubs gave Carol Dunbar a different view of mothering.
I never used to think much about the environment. Don't get me wrong, I liked nature, but from a distance and out of my way. And then 12 years ago, as I pushed my two children in their stroller, a mother bear lumbered out from the woods. She came from my right and crossed the road not 10 feet away, the soft pads of her feet the size of dinner plates. I stopped behind my stroller, my two children, ages 3 and 3 weeks, sleeping inside. Then again from my right, two cubs tumbled out into view, sensed my presence, then plunged back into the foliage. The mother bear from the side of the road turned, sniffed, and rose on hind legs to her full height. The sight of her magnificence sent me sinking to my knees. Not 3 days earlier, I had called the DNR and asked them what to do about the bears plundering our bird feeder. Black bears are nothing to worry about, he said. The only time they're dangerous is if you get between a mother and her cubs. You don't want to do that. We were all in a fairly straight line. The mother bear to my left, the cubs to my right, and me with my sleeping children in the middle. I had given birth only 20 days prior, and this bear had also just given birth. The moment sharpest in my mind is when we made eye contact. It was like finding a stranger across a room who shared your experience and your reaction, so the connection was instant. She wasn't just a bear. She was a mother who knew I had my young with me, just as I knew about hers, and she didn't like the situation one bit more than I did. Instead of a complete freakout, a sane and tempered reasonableness rose through me, what I am sometimes capable of when at my best. I saw that our stillness was our only way of communicating. And so it seemed to me that we agreed as mothers not to move. We kept vigil. That bear stood at the edge of the road, and I crouched behind my baby stroller. Over and over, the cubs came out, squeaked, and hightailed it back into the brush. Finally, a car came along and the mother bear ducked away. I saw my chance. Using the car like a shield, I sprinted home with my stroller. I never saw those bears again. Our encounter could have ended any number of ways had that mother bear and I not struck an agreement that day, one that, for my part, I'm still trying to uphold. I no longer assume that what the beaver, the bat, or even an ant is doing isn't just as important as what I am doing. I feel a deep sense of loyalty to my environment, not just because I want to save it, but because I think it just might save me.
Carol Dunbar is a writer in northern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Erica Janik.
Thanks to Erica Janik, and thanks to Chris Molina and Brianne Chasso again for producing our program on spring foraging. By the way, Chris on Facebook has a reminder for us if we go out to forage. He says, the wood ticks are awful. Tuck in your pants legs and put on some repellent when you are out foraging. Well, thank you very much for that. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about food rules and some rollbacks of food rules with the Trump administration, and then it's our Week in Review coming up after 8 o'clock. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Maple syrup, wild rice, rose hip jam, acorn bread, wild ginger, mushrooms, peppergrass, and grapes, wild asparagus, sumac lemonade, hickory nuts, hog peanuts, wild onions, Labrador tea.